I said I was going under the assumption that we're dealing with a fairly straightforward, typical 100-watt rig, not running high power. We have to higher power, yeah, you got to be much more persnickety.
Yeah, yeah. You know what they say about when you assume.
No, seriously. Up to about 100 watts, you can cheat. When you get close to a kilowatt, no, no, no. You got to play by the book and be clean.
Okay, I was just trying to be a little glib. And there's another guy definitely who's kind of talking while we talk. You know, last time I unkeyed and heard this gentleman, and then I heard him again while you were transmitting. So the other person that isn't Ed, that isn't me, that's transmitting, please transmit now.
Okay, it's N2PHC. I'm going to be fading away soon. Is that a comment, please?
Suddenly.
Yeah, echo link's real difficult to wedge my way in. Yeah, I use a lot of wire antennas in different ways. One of the most excellent wire antennas is the Cobb Web. It's like a fan dipole, but it's horizontal, and it folds into itself. And it's configured in such a way that it works itself, that its own wires act as directors and reflectors, where it has gain. It actually has gain. So, in all directions. So it works omnidirectional because it folds into itself. The Cobb Web, C-O-B-B, because it was invented in England by a guy named Cobb, or Web, actually. Web. W-E-B-B. So it's called the Cobb Web antenna. Do you know of that antenna? Back to you.
Oh, this is the first I heard of this particular antenna. I have to look it up. I have problems, though, with omnidirectional increased gain because antennas are not active devices. They're passive devices. And you can't get more output than you put into a radiating antenna. The gain that we often talk about is the local gain because what happens is instead of an isotropic 360-degree, say, incandescent light bulb distribution of RF, you're squeezing it to different nodes, and that's where the gain is being made up. So you might be able to have a gain over 360 degrees, but in altitude, you know, going radially at right angles, you have to have some decrease in the intensity to make up for that gain with a loss someplace. The total isotropic radiation of an antenna cannot be greater than the amount you put into the antenna without violating a lot of laws of physics, and that earns you more than just a traffic ticket.
WB2EAZ with the beanbag theory?
Certainly. Please, feel free.
Every properly designed and built antenna with a decent SWR, the antenna pattern in three dimensions is like a beanbag. The pattern depends on how you squeeze the beanbag, where it bulges out, where it's pressed in. But the volume of the beanbag overall only changes with the amount of power you're running, assuming you have a proper antenna with a proper SWR. And like you said, if you get a gain in one direction, you're having attenuation in a different direction. But in the end, it all evens out.
You're going to lose me soon. I'm going into the hinterland. I run a Cobb Web antenna at my primary location. It's an excellent antenna. It's a wire antenna. It runs on 5 bands. It has it's like a fan dipole. It runs horizontal. It's beautiful. I've run it for many years. Very, very good antenna. Well, it comes from England. Cobb Web antenna. And British run a lot of smaller antennas because they have small properties. That's the way they run them over in England. A lot of properties. So they have smaller little areas to run antennas. But I run the Cobb Web at my property in Alliance, Nebraska. Omnidirectional dipole. They're folded on themselves. 5 of them. Run with a very, very good antenna. And every dipole has gain because They're very good. It's a very good antenna. Look it up. Cobweb. And I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be fading away in the next couple go rounds. Back to that control.
Getting back to Oswala Land.
Okay, very good. Once again, thank you, Ken. And I will look up cobweb antennas. Again, not quite sure to make of the omnidirectional increased gain. There's got to be some kind of a gotcha there, but I'll take a good long look at it. All right, thank you.
Sort of like the Yagi, you know, director, reflector, driven element. Driven element is the dipole that you're using. Directors are the ones you're not using, and the reflectors the ones you're behind. That's kind of how the mentality of the antenna is based. But that's why you have five bands. So it's a good antenna. And it withstood every storm that we had out here with 100-mile-an-hour wind fire. But you can buy them. You know, MFJ sells them, but they're very difficult as you said, tune. It takes all day to tune, and then when you put it up in the air, it detunes itself because it's not on the ground. And then you should use a tuner because it's going to be off by a little bit. 73s once again. This is probably going to be my last transmission because I think I'm coming to the point of no return. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ken. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the case also with the Yagis. It's always a nice idea if you're adjusting the resonance of the driven element of a Yagi to try and put it somewhere close to, you know, the situation of where you're going to be using it. Some people will, you know, put it, you know, 2 feet off the ground and adjust the impedance matching, you know, gamma match or delta match, and then when they take it all the way up to wherever it's going to stay, it's not terribly well tuned for that location. So if you're going to adjust the tuning of an antenna, try and find a place that doesn't necessarily have to be the final resting place, but it has to be vaguely similar, because otherwise, you know, it's not necessarily going to be tuned for that. So I thank you, Ken. I thank you, Ed, as always. I thank everyone who participates. Once again, if anyone has any comment to make, please do.
May I ramble a moment more?
You are always free to ramble on my technical net, Ed.
And don't forget, if you have an antenna up by the roof of the house with trees around it, don't obsess over getting all of your radiation patterns just right, because the surrounding stuff is going to change everything slightly. Not enough to make a real difference, but enough to be detectable, depending on the weather, the wind, all kinds of stuff. Second item. 10 kinds of sheets on that beanbag thing. A repeater antenna has a series of vertically arranged dipoles to focus the energy towards the horizon. So you can get a high gain around 360 degrees pointing at the horizon. And for that price you pay, don't send any energy up or down, which any repeater will say, yeah, that's just fine with me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very common aspect of the collinear designs, the GP6, the GP9. The Diamond has a bunch of them, where it's a omnidirectional signal, but it's like collapsing a cone down to just a pizza slice, if you will. And so little is going up where it would be worthless, or down where it would be worthless, or even too far up or too far down, but just where it's the sweet point where the takeoff angle is going to intersect the repeater antennas out there in the distance. So, yeah, that's how you can get an omnidirectional gain for a passive device. But you gotta rob Peter to pay Paul. So you got to rob the high-altitude and less-altitude nodes to feed the medium-altitude nodes.
Okay.
VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Jim, KD2VHD. I was just looking at these cobweb antennas. What they are, they resemble an old-school one-post clothesline with the square circles of the clothesline running around, but it's flat rather than tapered. And it has multiple loop antennas wrapped around it, fed from a single feed point. So it's, I guess, almost like collinear or coaxial loop antennas. I figured I'd put the description out there because I was curious myself.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Sounds complicated. Like I said, after the net is over, I'll rummage through Google and see if I can make heads or tails of this design. There are so many different antenna designs out there, occasionally so many that people tend to forget some of them. They get reinvented 20, 30 years later only for someone to show someone else an old copy of a QST that's kind of seen better days and say, see, you know, people were using that back then, type of thing. So, you know, the more the merrier. Antennas are probably the principal mystery in this hobby. You know, electronic circuits, very few of us are clever enough to design our own old-style analog radio and certainly not software-defined radios. So most people put their time and effort and expertise in playing around with pieces of wire and coming up with all kinds of interesting designs for radiating antennas.
They sure do. And Ed, thanks for your input. It's always quite focusing. Which is 82VHD back to that.
Okie doke. Well, thank you again. Thanks to everyone. This, again, is AC2GS and still the Limewire Technical Net. Still have a little bit of time left, so if anyone has any topics for discussion or comments to make or questions, please feel free. Get that push to talk. And, you know, as always, if it isn't amateur radio related, we're open to discuss any aspect of science and technology. We'll try our best.
I think I should outline my favorite antenna, WB380.
Sure, Ed.
Imagine 36 vertically polarized doggies, most of them being five elements, I think up to four elements at the ends, each one with its own phase shifter, give you a few minutes of a couple of degrees zero.
Okay.
Are you going to ask me how I could afford it? I'm sorry, did I come through?
You came through, but I don't know if we understand the question. Where would you put it?
Where would I put it? Obviously, on top of an airplane.
Oh, no, so we're off of HF, I imagine.
Oh, God, no, Wingate.
Well, that's a horse of a different color.
No, it is the radar identification, or IFF antenna, on top of the Navy's new E2-DS and Delta Hawkeye.
Ah, I know a little bit about that plane. A teeny, teeny little bit. We've talked about this before. That was up on top of that thing.
Well, it depends which revision of the plane. It's been around in one form or another since the 1960s. I know the Delta model.
So, go on about the antenna.
The IFF antenna, which runs at 1030/1090 megahertz, is a broadside array of Yagis, all pointing in the same direction, but each one has a phase shifter. And the phasing between the antennas allows you to steer the beam over a reasonable range, as well as being mechanically rotated on the flying saucer on the top of the plane. You look up AWACS E2 Hawkeye of any revision, but E2D is the most recent. See this big flying saucer up on the roof. That's what I'm talking about.
I'm somewhat familiar with the plane. Years ago, I worked on some 1553 data bus terminals that went on that plane. I knew a little piece in a little place on that plane. But not very much. Not like you.
From 2003 to 2014, that was my baby.
I lost the middle of that transmission.
From 2003 to 2014, ISF part of the E2D Advanced Hawkeye was my baby.
Well, that's an important project. I'm quite impressed.
So am I. I miss it terribly.
Sounds like that was your high point. That's pretty cool.
No two ways about it. Oh, God, yes, that was the high point. Well, I don't know. When I was much younger, I did a flight test on a microwave landing system. Between those two, they're the high point.
Well done. Back to Roy if he's still there.
Yeah, hopefully I'm still there. The waveform looks right, so I guess I'm still here. During the early portion of that, for some strange reason, my internet access kind of dropped out, but it recovered rather quickly. There's more points of error for this setup than it is for you guys who just have a transmitter and a receiver.
I believe in simplicity.
Believe in it.
Let me rephrase that. I have worked on some things that are not remotely simple, but when it's on my own time, I believe in simplicity.
Well, in a perfect world, I would agree with you completely. I would much rather just push down the trigger of my ICOM 7100 and chat with you using RF. But for some strange reason, the repeater doesn't really seem to be interested in receiving my poor little signal down in the edge of Brooklyn, right next to Coney Island. So I'm stuck with the kludges that are necessary to accomplish the mission.
And you live right near my favorite named street.
Which is?
A little dinky street right near you, Dank Court, D-A-N-K.
Yes, I know it very, very well.
A long time ago in a galaxy far away, I used to walk past there periodically, and the name always struck me as being completely absurd.
Okay, I must have walked past it when I could just barely read, so I think I just incorporated it as part of the nature of things. I didn't put two and two together because I barely learned about two and two at that point. So I moved into the area when I was 5 years old.
Well, I lived in Luna Park from the time I was 15 until I got married. And what was it, Shell Lanes? I used to occasionally walk there and go right past Dank Court.
Yes, a relatively popular bowling alley that still is there. There's not that many things that were open 50, 60 years ago that are still open. I remember there was across the back street a poultry place with live chickens. When I went to David A. Booty, right off McDonald Avenue, I took the elevated. It took me off on Avenue U, which is Kings Highway, I forget. Anyway, there was a chicken, there was a poultry place there as well. Both of those things closed decades and decades ago. But Shell Lanes, as far as I'm aware, unless they closed it in the last week, is still operating. It demonstrates the nature of bowling. You know, countries might come and countries might go, but apparently bowling remains.
I have a question. The elevator on McDonald Avenue, was it still the D or had it already changed to the F?
From my earliest recollections, it was always the F.
October 1967, they made some changes, and what had been the D train became the F train. And there was some other juggling around. I was going by subway up to City College at the time. And it was absolute chaos. And I was the only one on the train who had read months and months and months of Transit Authority announcements, and it was amazing how many people were asking me for directions.
Okay, I guess that was right before I started at junior high school, because I went to David A. Booty, and you know, one of the things they gave you was a transit pass. I got on the elevated. It was definitely an F train at the time, and I took the two stops to Kings Highway, got off, went down, walked a few blocks away from McDonald Avenue, got accosted by people asking for money and bullies and all kinds of terrible, terrible people for about 3 years, and then went off to Abe Lincoln High School, which was orders of magnitude finer than Booty had ever been. And I had great science teachers, and I had a relatively fun time there. But that was just straight walking. I was walking in the opposite direction to Ocean Parkway and such.
Yeah, my senior year, when we moved to Coney Island of high school, we were zoned for Lincoln, but I was already going to Stuyvesant, Manhattan. And I just went by train that year.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's a good school, too. I mean, I really have fond memories for Lincoln High School. I went there at the same exact time that the famous baseball star Lee Mazzilli. I bumped into him once at graduation practice, I think. That was the only thing we had in common in all the years that I spent in the high school. It was very interesting. We had an intersection. The guy who was the coach of the softball team was the head of the science department and the guy who taught physics. So I took his class, and he was very nice. He gave me some kind of award so that I could show up on the stage. And, you know, I was always into chemistry and physics and all kinds of fun stuff. So I remember fondly many of my science teachers at Lincoln. We had a guy called Mr. Zuckerman who used to tell us stories of he had dropped out of medical school, and he had great stories. He passed away a few years ago. He retired to Florida and passed away. But then I'm sure Mr. Isaacson passed away as well, because he's probably about 50, 60 years old when I was 17. So I have very fond memories, as I'm sure you do in your high school.
Oh, yeah. And K2KNB and the late K2YEW went there just before I did. And to this day, Rich still teases me about being there after he was.
Oh, but the prize is you get to be younger.
That's true, that's true. All right, let me not monopolize this.
Okay, Ed, but it's always good to hear from you. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. We love to talk technology. We love to talk science. There's all kinds of things happening in the world. I'm more than happy to put my two cents in about it. So if there's anyone out there who would like to start the ball rolling, please hit that push-to-talk button.
82VHD with a ham radio-related question for a moment.
Oh, goody. Okay. Jim, let it rip.
So I put some pieces together during that conversation that I hadn't before, and I throw them out to you guys who will probably be able to figure out better than me. Time a year ago or so, they revamped the antenna app, and I'm probably 40 miles due east of that, and my reception and being able to receive and transmit to that antenna increased dramatically. I'm about 10 miles south of the Feldman antenna, and I get to a ridiculously little antenna I'm talking to around now. But I could probably talk to Glenn Oaks on an antenna with a little static. If I understand it correctly, that antenna array is a series of folded dipoles around the tower. Your ability to get to that repeater diminished at that time. I would be willing to bet, based on Ed's beanbag theory, that the west-facing dipole on that array is not functioning properly. For your consideration.
Well, you know, in the good old days, I could pick up a phone and talk to someone who has almost daily control many aspects of the repeater, but those days have passed. And I sort of had the same sensibility. The new design for the newest, the greatest repeater antenna in Glen Oaks, as you mentioned, is a quad-folded dipole. There are four folded dipoles. Theoretically, each and every one of them is going off at a 90-degree offset from the others to allow a somewhat omnidirectional radiation pattern. But maybe if the 90-degree offset, which is fully adjustable, is not exactly 90 degrees, there might be some relative blind spots that could be corrected if someone cared. So I don't know. I've sort of mentioned it in the past. The responses I tend to get back is it's perfectly omnidirectional. It's just a lot of buildings in the way, but I don't know. It's not like I have a way of kind of discerning the topology between me and a repeater. But that thought of yours, Jim, has been thought before.
WB3AQ is on.
Certainly, Ed.
There is a word, multipath, which means at RF the world is a hall of mirrors. Everything reflects signals and things add, they subtract, they increase it. But usually it's pretty constant. We're talking about large structures that aren't trying to blow in with the breeze. But, you know, if they put up a new building or change a building or something like that, that's going to alter an antenna pattern because of, you know, destructive and destructive mixing of reflections.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. Like I said, that's sort of what I've been told. But then again, if you have a kind of really adjustable antenna and your adjustments tend to favor areas of the Long Island community that are more populated with club members than, say, others, it might lead to some kind of slight blind spot, perhaps.
Can I give an example of what I'm talking about? Are you familiar with these, I don't know how popular they are these days, automotive Doppler scan, you know, systems on cars?
And to a degree.
In typical installation, you put up a circular array of four, maybe eight antennas, a receiver and a processor, and the processor typically has a circle of LEDs that indicate direction. Make sense?
Yeah, I used to have these discussions with Andy, WA2CDL, may he rest in peace, because he was kind of a big guy with fox hunts.
Yeah, so among one of the crazy things I worked on, but I don't have any terribly interesting stories about it, was a Sirius Doppler scan with a 16-element array in a 10-foot circle that would invariably be mounted up on a tower for a traffic control. And one thing I learned there is the larger the array, the more it cancels out the multipath reflections. Now, if you're going to put it on the roof of a car, you're very susceptible to multipath. And the way to use those Doppler scans in a car is as you're driving, the lit LED is bouncing around over about a 45-degree range, and you eyeball average it. And if you stop at a traffic light, you're probably getting a bad indication because the multipath isn't changing, so you can't eyeball average out the bouncing.
Oh, okay. I mean, I've seen YouTubes, and I talked to Andy about it. I never actually saw one in action.
Like I said, if you're not moving, you get a number that may not be right. But as you move, the multipath environment is changing, and you're exploring all the combinations, and you typically get it bobbling around over a 45-degree range, so you just mentally go for the center of the blob.
Yeah, it makes sense. I remember Dick, may rest in peace, used to tell how he was blocked to talk to someone he regularly talked to, but he kind of did a pool cue type of thing where he reflected it off a water tower. So, yeah, reflections are important. Multipath, I grew up with multipath. Multipath was what caused all of us to see double and triple ghost images on our old black and white TV sets.
Another example, if you're listening to an AM radio in the car, there are some places that you get what's called the picket fencing effect. An AM broadcast is very susceptible to that, whereas you drive, you hear it come in and out in a predictable fashion. And that is the multipath is alternately adding and subtracting, almost a weak enough, such that sometimes you get total cancellation and the signal disappears for a fraction of a second.
Yeah, I've read about picket fencing. I don't really think I noticed it or recognized it if I did, but I mean that makes particular sense. My father didn't own a car anyway, so there's very little picket fencing outside of cars for the most part, as far as I am aware of. By the way, there's someone who keeps on trying to talk. Maybe we should be quiet for a second or two and give them a chance.
82VHD with a comment on the topic.
Yes, Jim, please.
Very interesting aspects of this stuff. I am no RF engineer, but I will comment that if your change of ability to reach the Glen Oaks repeater corresponded with its change of antenna, my ability to hear it and transmit to it changed completely with the antenna. I will just say, via Ed's theory of the beanbag, beans are in my shack, 40 miles east, not in yours, and that's what you're dealing with. That's my side of the size up of the situation as a mechanic, not as a RF engineer. So, for what it's worth, that's my thought.
Okay, so we're kind of in agreement. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I've kind of lightly suggested that it would be really nice if I could be able to directly get into the repeater. Maybe someday, back again in the old days when I had a regular connection with the repeater crew. There was some talk of expanding the footprint of repeater nodes into this area of Brooklyn to kind of spread it south. I don't know what the status of that might be. Instead, I think they expanded it to three islands. Some repeater that someone donated, thankfully. So nothing has come to Brooklyn as far as I'm concerned, so I'm playing around with All-Star, and my ICOM 7100 is sitting here just kind of staring at me quietly.
I'll end my thought with a little bit of Brooklyn humor. Is Brooklyn in Long Island or is it on Long Island? My cousins that live there always have a fun conversation to have about that. Back to you, Roy.
Interesting question. Brooklyn and Queens are obviously part of Long Island. If you cannot see the political divisions, it's all one place. And people just get totally wrapped around those arbitrary lines.
Well, I think most lines tend to be arbitrary. I am willing to bet, I would be really interested to know the percentage of people living on Long Island proper that are blissfully unaware that Brooklyn and Queens is at one end of it, and it's not a separate area. Obviously, people who drive cars know when they're going over bridges and not. But there's a lot of pedestrians out there, and I just sort of, every so often they'll do a poll and they'll ask people whether they believe in evolution versus creation or a flat earth versus a globe. I would love to get some kind of a sense of what percentage of Long Islanders are completely unaware that Brooklyn and Queens is connected to them directly.
I have a slightly different take on that subject.
We share?
Do I?
I believe that has gotten much worse with the advent of GPS navigation in cars. where I'm going, or should I elaborate?
Well, I assume you're alluding to the loss of maps, which are visual cues of the topology often, whereas GPS is just turn right, turn left, go this way, go that way, type of thing.
I can give you dozens of personal examples of people punch their destination into the GPS. They follow the directions, and for all they know, we should be sending them to Afghanistan.
Now, things have gotten, thankfully, a lot better with GPS, but if you remember during the early times where they had the occasional complete gap where a GPS advised people to drive into a riverbank and such, and most times, thankfully, they didn't, but occasionally they did.
Yeah. Here's one. Roy, you don't know this one. VHD, you still there?
I'm here, Roy. And
I assume you periodically drive across Long Island Railroad bridge crossings. Have you seen the plastic sticks they stuck in along the road between the, so this, not between the rails, but between the tracks?
No,
I haven't seen them.
Well, being plastic, they tend to break off. But Roy, on the Long Island Railroad, where there's a grade crossing, they put these, like, plastic sticks between the tracks to kind of remind motorists, no, don't turn in here.
Yeah, it's something about never underestimating the stupidity of people.
And being some people realize they made a mistake when they hit the stick and break it, which may explain why VHD hasn't noticed it.
It might be because I rarely make a left or right at the railroad crossing and run over the tracks. I'll give you the mathematical explanation for what you described.
You are going to?
Believe it or not, I am.
I'm ready.
Okay. This is a, this is my, VHD, law. Kind of like, Ohm's law. Half of all people are below average.
So what you're saying is half of all people aren't even up to the average level of intelligence. I've seen that before. Is that what you're talking about?
Just math.
I have to respectfully disagree. Not that you're wrong. I think a large part of it is willful ignorance. That I think there are a lot of people out there who just don't want to be bothered to worry about things that aren't right in that face.
Both things are true at the same time. If you fill your head with, you know what the score of a football game was in 1962, if even football was played then there's some other important thing that's not in that neuron. So there's things like that.
But that reminds me of, I'm to this day active in the Boy Scout, and years and years and years ago, when I was actually living near Roy, Coney Island, and I was a scoutmaster of a local Boy Scout group, and I was like in my 20s at the time. I had one kid who was very shy and retiring, and didn't get him to open up on very much. He was obviously was bright, but this wasn't interesting. But when it came to sports tours, he could name every play and stat cold turkey. How's that for misplaced attention?
I got a better one. I had a kid that would, we'd go on a scout trip, and as we'd cross over those grade crossings, and there was a train like going over the parkway or something like that, he would go, that's the 515 to Ronkonkoma.
What?
This guy had the train schedules and the map so ingrained in his head that he knew what the train was as we were randomly driving through, you know, crossing a crossing above or below it.
Wait a minute. KU2OGB should do that, but there's a reason. He works for the railroad.
Well, this other kid works for the railroad, too, but my brother drives the damn trains. He couldn't do that for at the sake of his life. This kid knew every train on every track.
My son had a friend who, for a few years, worked in baggage at Kennedy Airport, and he would watch a plane flying overhead. And he can give you the airline, the flight number, and where it's coming in from or going out to.
So, half of all people are below average, but it varies with every topic. So, back to Roy. I think we have somebody coming from out west.
Well, almost west. I think that was W2BZ on Echolink. We'll give him a chance in 1 second. I just want to mention that at least in the UK, they call those guys train spotters. They made a movie called Train Spotters, but it was a different subject entirely. But even Monty Python did a skit about a train spotter. These are people who have memorized every model, every configuration. They know trains backwards, sideways, and they know their timetables. So as you mentioned, Jim, if you mention any kind of train and ask, you know, when they're coming to a particular station, they will tell you the exact time listed in the tables because, you know, these high-accuracy watches were kind of designed for trains. Because it was very important that the people know when the train's coming, when the train's going, and what have you. So you were discussing basically train spotters.
I have a bit to say about that.
Okay.
Item number one, yes. I did not see the movie, but I did read a lot about it. And they said the purpose was, it was sort of a metaphor for just how much of a waste people had made their lives obsessing about unimportant stuff. And transporting fine stuff was actually a metaphor for obsessing about something that actually is completely of no relevance whatsoever. Now, on the other hand, I am a train spotter. You know, once upon a time, I was working on the railroad all the live long day. I worked on railroad trackside safety equipment. I've done a lot of crazy stuff, but I got to know a lot about trains. And I will make the following statement. I talked to Ken, who I've spoken to before. I spent a lot of time in Nebraska on the Union Pacific North Platte subdivision, which is the daily way. That's why Ken. And we were running tests. And I will tell you, 4,800 horsepower, pulling 108 fully loaded cars of coal from the powder mill basin. That is one impressive thing. And there was a couple of times I had to stand 15 feet from the tracks. And you didn't think you were going to die. You knew you were going to die.
They are impressive machines. I've seen it.
And anybody who says diesel locomotives don't make smoke has never gotten a snootful of diesel exhaust hitting him like a smack in the face.
I think everyone kind of takes trains for granted, unfortunately. The trains and the tracks that were built across country changed the face of the United States. They have a lot of historical relevance that are lost on some people, but a few people kind of obsess on them. Yeah, train spotters, it could have been the reason why the guy who wrote it called it train spotting. There was one scene that took place near tracks where a train passed by, but it was quite incidental. But it was a very weird but particularly fascinating movie. So if there's anyone out there who never saw Train Spotting, it's probably available on every other streaming service. So take a look at it. It's it's a little bit weird. It's a lot weird, actually. But there was some good acting there.
I thought.
Sure.
I think if you ask the average person who is the cookie or the train spotter or the ham, we know the answer.
Unfortunately, I think most people's response is, what's a ham?
I know. Most of them is, I don't know what either of those things are.
Well,
again,
people might have a slightly better idea or sense of the word just because the movie was rather popular, even again, it had nothing to do with train spotters and such. So, I don't know. That's another good question. What would be the percentage difference between people who knew what a ham was and what a train spotter was? I'll repeat a story. At one of my meetings at the Kings County Radio Club, The cleanup crew for the place that we used as a room passed by, and one of the people kind of looked at us and said, "What is this?" And we said, "It's an amateur radio club." And she said, "What, you play music?" So certainly she would have failed that particular test, but I didn't think to ask her about Train Spotter.
I have another Train Spotter personal story.
Okay, Ed?
A few years ago, for about 8 months, I had a consulting gig being a fairy tale troll. No, a fairy tale, a troll is an ogre under a bridge. I leave the ogre part up to you, but the under the bridge was the Triborough. I pulled in to support some electrical work they were doing on the Triborough Bridge. Also, there are railroad tracks that parallel. If you ever go over the Triborough Bridge, you see the Hell's Gate Bridge next door, which is a railroad bridge, which carries both the Amtrak Acceleration trains and some freight. And when I was there, whenever a train went by, I would stop what I was doing and watch. The people I was working with thought I was crazy because I was, you know, I was noting the power end, what units, how many units, what the markings were, and the consist, what the type of consist is. I was also listening for any kind of defects, and my coworkers thought I was absolutely insane.
Well, you had the curiosity then that you still have now, and I hope I have similar curiosity over at the Shack. I have a big picture of good old Albert, and I have what hopefully is a quote of his: "I have no special talents, I am only passionately curious." So this net of ours is full of people, I hope, who are passionately curious.
I have a question for you on that subject.
Okay?
In all seriousness, I'm serious about this. I think the secret to Einstein was he had a heretical idea that time is not absolutely fixed. Time can be variable. And everybody thought he was absolutely bonkers. And then when it turned out he was right, the world changed.
Well, I certainly think that's part of it. He had a very fluid concept of a lot of things. One of the big things was Newtonian physics had a gaping problem. According to Newtonian physics, there was a fundamental frame of reference, a universal frame of reference, in which distances were constant, time was, the rate of time was constant, all these things were constant, which unfortunately you couldn't really work out legitimately. It was one of those things that unfortunately Newton took for granted. Einstein didn't take it for granted. Einstein had all these delightful thought experiments that demonstrated at least that our perception of length and height and time were dependent on things like velocity or acceleration or gravitational field. And he was able to whip it into a legitimate theory using a lot of math that was not his. He was a more concepts guy than a math guy, but he drew from some of the more brilliant mathematicians of the time, Lorentz being one of them, who didn't really like Einstein much, but nevertheless. So, yeah, he was able to conceive of a universe with no standard reference frame. Everything, as the saying goes, is relative.
Yeah, and basically I think we're saying the same thing. I'm just debating how much of that came out of starting with maybe time is not totally fixed, and the rest fell out from there. I have no idea. I'm just a bit bored.
Yeah, I understand. The problem is, I think from the get-go, Einstein was brilliant enough to put the whole thing together, and there is really no such thing as just space or just time. But the quantity that the universe is embedded in is a concept, four-dimensional concept known as space-time. And so once you make that big leap, then you can warp any aspect of it. You can warp space, and you can warp time. And, you know, just the idea that time flows at different rates at different places of the world can be very annoying to people. They really prefer a set reference point. And yet, if we didn't have relativity, it would be very difficult to make sense of the GPS systems because the atomic clocks wouldn't make any sense because they're above us under a slightly lower gravitational field, and so time passes at a different rate for the GPS satellites than it does for us standing on terra firma.
Yes, and many things ask any pilot about that one.
Wise to my theory.
I could chat all this stuff for forever. Rich, W2BZ, I think you're trying to say something on Echolink. Let's all stay quiet for a couple of seconds and give Rich a chance. Oh, well, I guess Rich stepped away from the Echolink. Well, we got a little bit more time. If anyone has any comment to make before we close this portion of the technical net, hit that push-to-talk button.
I got more heresy I just thought of.
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, a couple of comments. May I go back to the 10-meter discussion from a bit earlier?
Sure.
Yeah, I did, and I saw the same thing yesterday. It's one of the local guys on the my local ham club, Holmesburg Amateur Radio Club in Northeast Philadelphia, posted that, hey, this wall-to-wall DX from the bottom of the band to 29.0. That was yesterday. The band did sound like 20 meters when I got on to try to work some countries I had not worked yet on 10 meters. For anything other than garden variety, the big multi-ops, piled on with even well-equipped 100-watt and offset effect dipole station overlooking the ocean. It wasn't easy to get through. But the more what I've heard is 10 meters is better than it has been in years. I did make, earlier in the week, I made one unusual contact. 9 o'clock at night, exactly 3 hours after sunset, on FP8, I worked Victor Kilo 7 X-ray, which, for those who don't track this stuff, that's Tasmania, which is south Australia's smallest state, and way to the south. The only thing I could figure, for 3 hours after sunset, that's kind of amazing, even for FT8 probably. The only thing I could figure is that Tasmania is so far south, for propagation purposes, it's almost a north-south path. I thought that was kind of crazy. I mean, anyway, I know you're kind of a 10-meter buff, and yeah, I am beginning to agree with you that FT8 does not seem to follow the normal rules of propagation. Go ahead.
Yeah, FT8 is truly a magic technology. Joe Taylor should get another Nobel Prize for this one alone. I wouldn't say for years. 6 months ago, 10 meters was jumping all over the place. I was terribly optimistic. And then spring turned into late spring and early summer was just disasters. The bottom completely fell out of the band, and it was dead for months upon months. I brought it up here on the technical net, and there was some chatter that there were other solar events that disrupted the ionosphere and screwed up 10 meters, but it was awful. But It was good 6 months ago, and it was beautiful today and yesterday as well. Really busy, full of people. Didn't hear anyone from Tasmania. I saw a YouTube just the other day, a zoologist type of guy made a trip down to Sydney, and he showed a couple of Tasmanian devils, which, you know, is imprinted in my childhood memory, because Looney Tunes had a cartoon character that was called the Tasmanian Devil that used to kind of rotate in a dervish way, raising a dust cloud and just wreaking havoc. So I always have a tender thought for Tasmanian devils. Certainly, Ed.
Nothing to do with ham radio. My brother spent some time in Tasmania, and he was absolutely blown in Tasmania, so far south, positively COVID. Reminded him of this. He never, ever, ever saw any.
Oh, okay. I don't know how populated the animals are there. You know, it might be very few and far between. The ones that I saw on the YouTube were in a zoo already. So I'm sure that there's a lot of animals that unfortunately mankind has basically done away with. Although I do understand that Australia has the largest number of venomous snakes in the world. So if you're out there looking for venomous snakes, Australia is your place.
That's a little overwrought.
As long as they don't get into my food at Outback.
No, seriously. My brother lives in Brisbane for the last 40 years. You want to hear his take?
Okay, sure. I'm just telling you what I heard secondhand. It's not like I visited Australia.
Yes, that is true. But you have to go to some parts of Australia where absolutely nobody lives. Now, my brother lives in Brisbane, and they even have an analog there to the Long Island Railroad. You've never seen a pit viper on the train.
Okay. I mean, you got to kind of keep in mind, my understanding of Australia is that the central region is arid desert land with a lot of snakes and other kinds of reptiles and such, and the livable areas are the coastal rims around the subcontinent. So, yeah, although Australia has a large surface area, a lot of it is stuff that you can't really do much with because it's basically a desert in the middle.
Yeah, my nieces, actually, some of my family have done public service work in the outback of Australia, and you're pretty much right, the center of Australia. It's not a true desert. Parts of it are, but much of it is just, you know, good for herding sheep and little else.
Okay, that's good to know, and unfortunately, I think they had decided to not pass some kind of new law protecting the Aboriginal people of the subcontinent. You know, almost everything has been populated by human beings for thousands of years. It's just a matter of kind of pushing the old owners off to the side and setting up shop yourself. So, now, a little disappointed. Perhaps the law wasn't well written. I don't know, but hopefully they'll be kind enough to their Aboriginal. Even Japan has Aboriginal Japanese that are a different ethnic group that I don't think they're particularly that kind to, unfortunately.
Oh, help me! As God is my witness, I am telling the truth. I was sitting next to an Australian Aborigine at a wedding. Want to hear about that?
Okay. There are. There's a guy who directed Thor, I think. He's not 100%. I think his father was Aborigines, and of course his mother was Jewish.
Now, here's what happened. I told you my brother lives there. The one time I went to Australia was in 2006. My brother calls me up, says, my daughter's getting married, and I don't care what it takes. do want to be there. If I have to come there and spray you here myself. And, oh, by the way, if you can spray Mom with you, that would be wonderful.